Hi everyone, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the following podcast belong solely to the host and its contributors. They are not necessarily the views of our employers, organizations, committees, or other group or individual.
I'm David Campbell.
And I am Jordan Bullock.
And I'm Joseph Whitney. This is Brewing with BIM,
where we talk about construction processes, technology, BIM, and beer.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Brewing with BIM. I'm Joe Whitney, and with me, as usual, is Dave Campbell and Jordan. What's going on, fellas?
What's up, Joe?
What's going on, Joey?
Well, not much. We've got a great guest here with us, and he's in person. He's in my office, which is awesome. Mr. Adam Wingerston. Am I pronouncing that? I'm probably butchering your last name. I always just call you Adam.
It's Wingerston.
Wingerston.
Everybody likes to take the S and the T, and they do the little swap on it. So I don't get too offended, because I've been dealing with it for a long time.
I spell it correctly, but I can't say it correctly.
Yeah.
It's like Massachusetts. It always trips people up.
You're not alone. Don't worry about it. I'll give you a pass.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, man. I appreciate it. All right. Before we get too far down this rabbit hole and talking about Adam and all the great things he's doing and his wealth of knowledge, let's go around and ask everybody what they're drinking. Dave, I'll start with you, man.
Ah, dude, so you're not going to like it, but I'm loving it so far. my brother stopped over at Misbehavin' Meads. I smoked a brisket this weekend and had some family stop over, and he and I share the same tastes. So he got me a cup of fruit Misbehavin' Mead, which is a peach, pear, grape, pineapple, and cherry cider. Then he got me a caramel apple cider and a peanut-coated caramel apple cider. So, and this one is actually aged in bourbon barrels for 9 months. That should be nice.
Well, that doesn't make me unhappy. I thought you were going to say peanut butter whiskey, and then you, I would lose even more respect for you. That and the Sinfire or Fireball.
I can't do Fireball at all. That stuff gives me such bad heartburn anymore. I know I'm an old man to say that, but good Lord, if I drink any cinnamon whiskey, it's going to be, I'm regretting it the next day for sure.
Fun times, man. All right, Adam, what are you drinking, my friend? You brought your own little cooler. It's all fancy.
Oh yeah. This is probably the part that I prepared for the most.
You're like, what do I wear? I mean, what beer do I drink?
Yeah, it's been a while, but I've been thinking about what I should be drinking and try to make it semi meaningful.
Yeah.
So I ended up going with a Sierra Nevada Torpedo Extra IPA.
Dude, that's a good choice.
Nice. One of the main reasons is that it was in my fridge. So that's probably its best qualification. But looking at some of that stuff and trying to figure out something that I wanted to have for this, Sierra Nevada really stuck with me. I don't know if anybody's had the opportunity to go to their brewery in North Carolina at all. It's like just outside Asheville. I've been there a couple of times, and I think the thing that stuck with me most, that impressed me the most, was their commitment to sustainability.
Yeah.
They got a LEED Platinum building down there. The whole area there, it's on a beautiful property, but they had to clear out woods for it, so they reused the wood from the trees to build part of the brewery. They got cisterns for collecting rainwater. They got solar panels all over the place there, trying to run some of that stuff. And then the thing that impressed me most is they have a CO2 collection system.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And so from the fermentation, it lets off CO2 or whatever. I'm not going to pretend I know the chemistry behind beer and all that, but apparently they collect all of that and they use it later on, put it in the kegs and things like that, for actually, like pressurizing the kegs for the beer taps and stuff when they're tap room. So I thought that was pretty cool. They scored a couple points with me on the tour, so I figured I would kind of give them some props and go with them on this.
Dude, that's pretty cool. I've been to a lot of breweries, but I have not been there. But I'm always amazed by all the cool sustainability features that breweries tend to focus on. They recognize, clean water is the essence of every beer, and having that focus is really, really cool. Like New Belgium's got a big thing. I had a friend that worked there, mm-hmm. and he said it was the greatest thing about it is working there was just their commitment to sustainability. So I imagine Sierra Nevada is similar.
If it's the I don't know if it's the same. So like in North Carolina, they're in Asheville.
Fort Collins, I think.
I was gonna say, because they're both from I think California, Colorado, and yeah. Then they both have a place in Asheville.
Oh.
But New Belgium's the same concept as that, and they're probably a close second on trying to decide or whatever. But they basically took an old trash pit on the side of the river in Asheville, rehabilitated the whole thing, built a lead platinum and a lead gold building there, and like everything they have is just like super cool. But like that's not necessarily the greatest area of town or whatever, but it's like, you know, kind of cool what they were able to do, cleaning up the place and everything. But that stuff's pretty neat. And,
I like that, man. I like that commitment to sustainability and, you know, rehabbing a brown site, you know, making it usable and actually making it a tourist destination is gonna be pretty up there. I knew Asheville had a lot of breweries. And I'm already burping for my beer. Jeez. Asheville had a lot of breweries. It's one of the coolest college towns ever. It's got a cool art scene. Mm-hmm. If I told my wife, if we were ever to retire anywhere and I didn't have to worry about being close to somebody, that's where we're moving. But yeah, it's nice to see that they got that kind of scene going for it. It's like almost like a mini Portland, if you will.
It definitely is, and it's kind of interesting that those, I mean, relatively speaking, Sierra Nevada and New Belgium are pretty large breweries.
They are. Yeah.
And as far as Asheville goes, it's probably really small micro craft stuff and everything, and they really sort of didn't forget that whenever they sort of moved into the area and sort of really try to fit in with the scene rather than, you know, being like an Anheuser-Busch moving into town or something and just doing whatever and...
Oh, dude. So Anheuser-Busch has this, it's like the coalition for microbrewers or whatever it's called. I forgot the name of it. And it's in Portland. It's all throughout the Pacific Northwest, really. But really, all it is Anheuser-Busch funding and figuring out who's rising the top for them to buy. And that's all they kept doing. They just keep buying breweries.
So they're the Autodesk of breweries.
No comment. No comment. Man. Well, I'm not drinking anything fancy. I'm, dude, it's beautiful outside. It's, I got no excuses, man. I got Michelob Ultra. There's no reason for it.
Two times in a row.
Dude, I am slacking. I thought about, Dave got me some Heaven's Door whiskey. It's sitting on my counter, and I thought about bringing that in. I'm like, I can't drink whiskey. Not this early on a Monday. Maybe that's like an afternoon Saturday, or Friday or Saturday episode. But Jordan, man,
speak,
tell me what
speak
you're
for yourself, Joe. I mean, I'm over here kind of sipping on a nice blended Canadian whiskey, actually. So, yeah, Monday afternoon, nice weather. You know, I'm enjoying this afternoon here.
He's out there in a hammock. Yeah.
I was going to say it is 80 proof. So, I mean, if I'm slurring words by the end of this episode, don't let me go to the dog park.
All right, man. All right, fellas. Sounds like Adam's got us all one upped on the beer side, and I don't know, Jordan. All right, man. Your whiskey's a close second, I guess. So with that, guys, let's dive into it. Adam Wingertson here. I've known you for probably 2 or 3 years now. You're with Lighthouse Electric doing some cool stuff over there. You guys are leading the charge in BIM, and then, you know, I learned about your background quite a bit, and just seeing your advancement through technology and what you guys are, what you specifically look at, like your mind for like looking at things and figuring out how they work and then figuring out how to apply it to construction. Like, that's pretty cool, your current role and stuff. So just give us a little bit about your background for our listeners.
Yeah. So background, basically I got a degree from Penn State way back in the day. I did what every other college kid did. They got out, didn't know what they were going to do when they grow up. Still trying to figure it out, but,
every day, man.
Yeah. Right. Basically I think for my position, I got a pretty interesting background. So, I had a cup of coffee as a sheet metal worker at one point. So started out with that and then ended up doing, for a mechanical contractor, being a project engineer, and got into the planning department, being basically the assistant to, the guy running the show there. That's not the assistant general manager, the, assistant to the general manager over there. But started doing that. So that was a mechanical and plumbing contractor, and really sort of got my first taste of quote unquote BIM, for what it was worth, back in the day in the Pittsburgh area, which, was basically a glorified 3D coordination. So Navisworks 2009 was my entry into that. That's pre-ribbon. That's still drop-downs and everything in there. So work there.
Clash detection or timeliner in clash detection?
We weren't doing anything with timeliner. Right. Haven't found, didn't really have a whole lot of use for that at the time. 4D was sort of a pipe dream back then. And really what everybody thought was BIM was just, you know, chucking five models into a Navisworks file and seeing where, you know, the whole, we want zero clashes or whatever. That's BIM.
Yeah, the BIM, BIM is VDC conversation gets lost in a lot of people. Man.
Basically, yeah. But yeah, I was doing that for a long time. Ended up becoming the manager of the planning department over there for 2.5 years. And basically the whole way through, I became getting into Navisworks like 3D coordination specialist. The mechanical contractor was probably like 50-50, whether we were running coordination or whether a general contractor was running that stuff. So I really got involved in that and learned a lot about the other trades. So I knew the three that I was involved with, but learned a lot about electrical and fire protection as I went along with all of that. After like a decade there, Lighthouse Electric, they had a nice position that was available and threw my hat in a ring for that one. I always admired the company from afar. They always worked really well with the mechanical contractor I was at, and you know, we were, had some pretty good projects together. But I always said from kind of the first day I worked with Lighthouse, I said, boy, if they ever had a job or offered me anything, like I'd probably go over there just because like I really liked the way that they were set up, how innovative they were and everything. And you know, it only took 10 years, but
Well, they've got a great team over there too. Dan Radicke, Jim's now gone, I guess, but Logan, like everybody there is just so easygoing, great to work with.
Oh yeah,
and everybody's humble. They know more than everybody, but they don't show it. They're just humble. Like, you know, I love working with them, man. And now you guys got Travis. Like,
yeah,
oh, man.
Yeah, my you know. Everybody there is humble. It's a very good team atmosphere that's happening over there, and nobody's, you know, putting themselves on a pedestal. I'll be the first one to hand out, you know, kudos to any of the team members that are there doing things, because as much stuff as I think I can do, I'm nothing without some of the people that I work with, because we have some newer people that are coming in, and the amount of knowledge that these guys have on just like, on doing different coding things and databases and all these different languages that they know as far as coding and stuff like that. It's like, I can learn all this, but like, it's going to take me a minute, and I got a whole bunch of other stuff going on too. But it's, those guys are they're killing it. They're really taking it to a new level where it's, you know, I was always slightly protective of my sort of, intellectual property and stuff there of, you know, not handing out a lot of the coding and stuff that I was doing. Where now I'm getting into the point where I'm a lot more comfortable with these guys sort of working on it, because I trust them that like, hey, they're going to do good work with this stuff. And the things that I was very protective of, that these are my baby, it's like, here, you can babysit for a while.
Yeah. You guys did a lot of hiring recently for that, the IT side, and have a wealth of knowledge on that side. Are you saying there's on the other side, on your side, there's even more coding staff?
There's a bunch of different stuff. So it's basically whatever we can find solutions to. So you guys had a thing on integrations versus automations and stuff. And then after listening to that, I have no idea what I do anymore. You really threw me for a loop on that. But basically, we're turning over any rock available. If there's anything that's a process that somebody's doing either at the company or just with the IT area in general, we're looking at ways that we can automate the whole thing. It's like, why not?
Yeah.
You know, we're not trying to eliminate people, but we're trying to eliminate mundane tasks to free them up to do more important things.
Yeah. Why copy data from this system to this system when you can free people up to be the creative problem solvers that they need to be, instead of just, if this is something that can easily be automated. You're never going to automate human creativity and their ability to solve complex problems, which is, as we know, that's all construction is. Everybody, you know, AI is going to take our jobs, and then there's no way. I'd love to see it build a building. It's just not going to happen. You know, we might get to a point where robots are able to, you know, hammer nails on a job site, OSHA approves it and all that stuff, but It's not going to be able to solve the problems that humans can. You know, coordination in its own right. You were talking about Navisworks. You know, that's a I've you know, been fortunate to see it change over the years, which is great because it used to be an 8-hour meeting, you know, every Friday, and you're solving all the most little things. Now it's there's tools out there that'll help you, you know, speed it up and, you know, it puts the power in everybody's hands so they can see the little micro clashes here and there and they can just deal with it before we get to the Friday meeting can actually, you know, solve real issues. But at the same time, it hasn't stopped that part of the industry from growing. It's actually still added the same amount of jobs, if not more. Now it just gave us more tools to manage the micro side, so we can still focus on the bigger, larger, complex problems. Because, you know, we still have the same problems. So, you know, the pipe still hitting the steel, or the whose responsibility is this? That, you know, you can't automate that part away. Somebody needs to accept that component of it. And then also we're getting to, you know, hopefully this is a part that like quantum computing or something can help us with, but like model sizes, geez, like they're getting freaking insane now. And I know we don't even have to share our fabrication level model and still running to model size capabilities that we would run this clash detection. We're spinning for a while, man. Navisworks loads up. I don't know how many issues you guys run into that sort of stuff, but there's real things that I don't think AI is ever going to fully solve. And humans are always going to be involved in this side.
It can't. And one of the things on that is that, you know, I see a lot of different programs that people are trying to inject some level of like fake intelligence in there. Like we can throw a bunch of components just wildly into a model for accounts or something like that. But like there's zero intelligence behind it other than you want to know how many thing bobs you got on your job. Like I can tell you, you know, with some level of like, you know, plus or minus 10% kind of deal. Whereas like, any of the solutions that I'm personally building that are, you know, scripting wise, those things, I am very careful not to take it too far. I want the human interaction in those things. I need somebody who has a brain and hands to click the keys and click the mouse buttons to do these things and put some thought behind it. You know, that's where one of the things that our company excels at is fabrication stuff. And for you to go in and just wildly place content, that doesn't work for us because that's never going to fly for fabrication.
Yeah, that goes back to our conversation before we jumped on this. There's a lot of tools that are out there now that seem to just dump stuff without any meaningful rhyme or reason. It's like, oh, you know, it meets a spec. But what spec? It's just your algorithm that's going through. And I feel like that's probably where we are at today with AI is we're getting content, but you still have to validate that content. And in most instances, the content that you're validating, the time you're spending validating that content, you could have just done the job. It's almost like you could have done it right the first time instead of, you know, using a tool that isn't meant to do it, forcing it to work, and in hopes that, you know, one day it'll get there. But, you know, we're still a long ways off. We're still a long ways off before we're ever to, I can just check the box and say, yes, AI is correct.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, I sat in a demo probably 3 or 4 months ago where a company, they had a new product and they're like, hey, check this out. And they're like, look, you can have it place hangers. It's like, okay, cool. Like, what does it do? And they show you, and then there's hangers overlapping each other and there's some that are 6 inches apart and they're just like in places. They're like, what is the theory behind this? Like, obviously that hanger's no good. They're like, well, you can just delete it after. And then you get to exactly what you're talking about. Like, why didn't I just place it in the first place then? Why did I even bother with your tool?
This goes back to a common thing that Dave and I talk about is like the blue beam counts thing, you know, like the visual count. Like, it's a great tool. It's really cool. It's a big wow feature, but I'm still spending the same amount of time because I still have to go back and count everything in that PDF set to make sure that the validation count is actually correct.
Yeah, right. Yeah, even with all of that too, if you're talking about those kinds of things, even a blue beam workflow where something's going to be on a drawing and it's going to be labeled and you're trying to get counts of something, if whoever put that content in their Revit file prior to printing out that PDF put in the wrong thing or didn't label it or had something turned off, I mean, it's garbage. It doesn't do you any good, and then you're just chasing your tail trying to figure that out.
Are you still at this stage? I mean, I'm far removed from looking at people's Revit models and actually being able to validate the information. Are you still seeing this as an issue where they'll fudge dimensions? Because this is the biggest issue for me when I was doing layout. And I just, I it's popping in my head as we're talking about this. Do you still run into that?
I can't speak for other contractors if they do that. I'm sure that there's some amount of that. We're really careful not to do that.
Yeah.
And
well, not specifically, but you're using the architect's model or somebody's model, right?
Yeah. Any of their stuff. Well, I mean, just take a model in general.
Yeah.
Going back to what you're saying about the coordination isn't the end all be all of the whole thing. A model is perfectly smooth lines. Everything's square. There's no sag in the deck. The decks are perfectly level. Everything is a perfect world as far as in the model. And then you have somebody come along and says, well, I want zero clashes. And you have somebody who's like, you know, you might have a contractor who's putting fake stuff in there, or like design content. Like design content is for just that design. It's not fabrication level stuff. So they put that stuff in there in their perfect world, and all of a sudden they wanted zero clashes. You achieve that, then you go out in the field and things are hitting. Like, well, how did this happen? It's like, that's not how reality is.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how. I mean, we preach and tout BIM, and it definitely has its you know, amazing attributes, and there's the ROIs there and everything, but it's only so good, right? You know, you could BIM it to death pre-construction. The construction side still happens, though. Like,
oh yeah, in a lot of it too. And I've found in the years of doing this is that there's a lot of people that don't know what they're looking at. Just saying, well, somebody told me this, so we have to achieve that. And when you say, well, just so you know, like that's not how the real world works. And they're like, well, my boss said I have to do that, so you know, we're gonna achieve this kind of thing. And it's when you start getting people that have done this that you excel at it. And that's one of the biggest things that I preach a lot is to say VDC, I think there's a huge issue with VDC. And the reason is that people that are doing VDC stuff, pure 3D modeling things, are not typically tradespeople. Some trades they are. But others, if they're not, those people have the field experience. They don't necessarily know what they're looking at until they have the experience of modeling that stuff over and over and over again. So without that field experience, they're just putting lines on paper, essentially.
There's nothing like having an architect work for a GC. The architect's in charge of coordination for all the subs, but the architect works. We've run into this before, where an architect works for the GC to run coordination because they know Revit. And so they're contracted out to do the coordination piece. The architect has, and he's an architect. He has no idea about MVP systems, but he's running coordination and clash detection.
Right.
But they had to check a box for the project, and they didn't want to pay the subcontractors for their time in coordination. But what I've seen a lot of times too is the subcontractors are like, "You guys are actually costing me money. I'll just do it for free. Like, just stop. Like, mm-hmm. You guys stop right now."
Yeah, I've had plenty of that. Or on the mechanical side, we were not in charge of coordination, and I would work with a general contractor while they were running coordination. I would assist to do some stuff just because it takes forever.
Yeah.
To do that kind of stuff. And you know, luckily when I was on the mechanical side of things, like they were all tradespeople drawing, so it worked out really well. But we were working with other trades that were not, kind of deal. You know, currently even like at Lighthouse, a lot of the VDC are not people with field experience. There are another position, PLD, that work with them in the planning department that are union electricians. So we fill that void with that. But you still run into VDC that are just, you know, somebody who got a, you know, a CAD degree or something from a school. And like, until they gain the experience and sit in the rooms and do the coordination and go to the field and see the stuff in real life, I mean, they're not going to, it's going to be tougher than to grasp those concepts.
Right. Trent will whip them into shape, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
That's good. Man, we literally were just on your background and we dove into all these topics. Crazy how these things happen. You seem to be focusing a lot of your time these days. So you said that you were with, you know, in your previous role, you were on projects specific and you oversaw a planning department. And when you started at Lighthouse, you're waiting for a project to come along where they could offer you a job. But your job today doesn't really seem to fit the you're on a project mentality, right? You're in a bit of a different realm these days, it seems like.
Yeah, I think even since I sort of went to Lighthouse, I was more project-based in the beginning. helping them out on projects. And one of the reasons that, you know, I was there and I got the position I did is basically they were getting beat up by some of the mechanical contractors on coordination jobs. And they're like, we are getting our butts kicked on this because they're telling us they can't move stuff. And I literally had meetings with Trent on the project he was modeling on and helped like go down a corridor in a model and redesign a lot of the ductwork so that, you know, our cable tray could fit in there. And that all seemed to work out well. So I was definitely on project side of things, doing a lot of Revit project setup things. But mostly I had Revit experience at that point. And we were at the infancy of, we want to create a library of Revit families. We want to build standards. You know, how do we achieve this? And basically I just started, you know, lending whatever knowledge I could into that whole thing. And that's sort of, you know, spiraled into where I'm at now, where I'm really not a project-based person, but I am a project resource when necessary. And at any point, people will reach out to me and say, hey, I got this going on my project. You know, what would you recommend? And I can look at that process and say, here are the three things that are possibilities. This is the one I recommend. And here's why I don't recommend these other two things that you could possibly do on here. I think that that's a more important message than saying, you should do this because I said so.
Yeah.
It's like, here's the three options. I'm going to tell you all of them and I'm going to tell you why you shouldn't do two of them. But like,
yeah,
you're going to learn from that more than me just saying, do it this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are.
It's our way. This is the way we've always done it. Instead of having that, it's, this is where the shortcomings were with these other two workflows and tools. So sorry, go ahead, Dave.
Well, I just wanted to ask real quick, Adam, you know, obviously Joey and I, know a little bit about your background and kind of what Lighthouse does. And one of the things I really wanted to highlight, we're already kind of moving towards this topic. You were just talking about, you know, building Revit families and a lot of the things that you need to do there as you start moving towards, obviously I want to get into some prefabrication and fabrication kind of talk workflows with you, but I wanted to take a second and see if I could have you talk about some of the things that you guys do. I mean, obviously, you're very knowledgeable on BIM. You understand VDC workflows. Coordination is huge. Another piece of that is layout. But can you give us an idea of what you guys at Lighthouse do as far as, you know, transitioning BIM out to the field?
Yeah, I mean, it all starts straight from the model going to the fabrication shop. So the idea that we have is, you know, the ideal, what everyone's trying to achieve is do as much stuff offsite as possible, deliver just in time, and have it go in efficiently, you know, shrinking costs and schedule the whole way. So a lot of what we do, you know, talking on the Revit families is that we've had a few people, and we have a couple of guys right now that work pretty extensively on Revit families. So as people come up with new things on projects, or just enhancements to stuff, we're constantly, you know, tinkering with our libraries to make them better, adding in more parameters. What kind of information can we build into these things to make them function better and really make them the intelligent parts that they're intended to be rather than just placeholder junk?
Mm-hmm. Well, and see, this is right where I was kind of hoping you'd go with this, man, because I know we were starting to have, you know, the conversation pre-podcast about add-ins, right? And there are a few add-ins out there that typically will stick out for Revit for this, you know, purpose. But some of the drawbacks that we found, you know, those are a double-sided coin either way that you look at it, whether you're using, SysQ, or you're using M Suite, or you're using Evolve. There's many different pieces out there, right? But one of the things, you know, you talked about earlier, and it kind of stuck with me, is a sense of, if you give somebody that control, like you have a dedicated database, which is great. You know, it'll be a database that you guys can pull in and you could start to utilize these Revit families. But the problem is, if they don't work for you, you're going to have to go back through and pretty much try to recreate or modify them to be able to work for you. And then the point I really, really loved earlier is when you mentioned, if you don't have a cut sheet, you know, they're not going to just build a family for you based on, you know, an idea. They're not going to build a conceptual thing for you. They won't just take that in and build it. So there are some limitations to these, you know, add-ins. And, you know, the piece I want to highlight is that you guys have kind of made that shift to actually do that internally and to manage the Revit families to create what you guys know translates well out into the field, right? You guys, you've built that understanding, you've made that plan, right, going into it, where you knew what information is going to be good, whether, you know, it's parameters, it's a point, different information, different data that can transition well out to the field and then come back round circle.
Yeah, and in those programs, they have their utility. And for companies that are just getting into actually doing modeling work, BIM, whatever you want to call it, those programs excel because they come with a database of parts. They give you buttons to click that do the things. I mean, it's a good product to use. And probably the biggest reason that we didn't go that route is that we were using some of them. And in meetings with those companies, we said, hey, we'd really love this component to do this, or like have this information, or be able to stretch or modify in this way. Can you do that? And the answer is no. Or it's like, okay, can we build our own and use that in your product? And the answer is no, because they need to build their product to work off something standard that they know is going to work. And that's where we were like, well, this isn't going to work. And I think that those programs, they definitely have a place in the industry, and they're definitely a good stepping stone to get into these processes. But at a certain point, you're going to outgrow them. You're going to want to start doing more fabrication and pushing more information to the field. And whenever you get to that point, your hands are going to be tied by that program, and you're going to have to get away from it. And I think that's the biggest thing, and probably the biggest reason why we are where we are, is we made that decision and said, none of these programs are going to get us to where we're going. They're going to keep us in the same track that we're in right now. And we want to advance. We want to be better. And we need to do something different. And that's what really led us into the whole content management side on our end.
Yes, sir. Now, I would say what I mean, obviously, you, like you said, you got a couple people kind of dedicated, but what have the I guess, other than having your own library, right, that you guys know and you guys understand, what would you say are the benefits and the drawbacks of the content management?
I mean, it's time to do all of it. That's certainly something. You have to sort of sift through the different requests, because some people will really try to take it to a certain level when you start building out more parameters, more geometry, and it leads to what Joey was talking about. You start end up with bloated models, and that's certainly something that we suffer from, is that the more things you're putting in there, the more advanced you make them, the cooler looking that they are, and they look like real pieces of geometry, it's going to bloat your model, and all of a sudden your model performance is down. And it's like you have to find the right balance of making a cool looking thing that meets the, you know, level of development requirements for a project, has the right amount of information that you can do what you need to do in there, but also not affect your performance, because every, you know, it's all dollars whenever you're dealing with productivity for labor. That's the biggest cost that we have.
Yeah. We're at a standpoint right now where it almost seems like, you know, you're managing multiple iterations of your model too. Like you have your design model, and, you know, maybe that's clash detection, coordination, and then there's a fab model maybe that goes along with it. But like the model that makes it to that you're sharing is, you know, of a certain size or only has a set amount of views in it or something like that. But then you have your own model, and I guess ABC Pros probably helped this aspect a lot, is what you're sharing and publishing. But we've seen a lot where, you know, hey, we ran coordination and then we did our fab and then we had to go back and re-coordinate something and never updated our fab, and then that has matched in the field. And then, you know, a lot of guys doing the fit and field sort of thing, and kind of making it work. And it lends into what the story you were telling us earlier, where, hey, this type's in the wrong spot and actually doesn't even go anywhere sort of thing. But I don't know, man, the bloated model issue seems to, like we see it a lot on the architect side, and we also see it a lot on the MEP subcontractor side. And on the MEP subcontractor side, a lot of times what we're seeing is they're using fabrication components inside of the design model. Do you guys run into that quite a bit, or?
No, I'd say not so much. Like as far as the design content, I don't know that we necessarily care that much. I mean, as far as like equipment locations and things, you do, you know, you pay attention to those kind of things. But, you know, I've experienced many a time where somebody puts a piece of equipment in a design model and it's like a year old of the, you know, basis of design, and that piece of equipment's actually twice as large as it as it shows on there. But especially on the electrical side, like one of the things that blows me away that the guys do is that I've always looked at electrical prints, and I come from the mechanical side of things where they literally draw everything. They label everything for sizes exactly the way it's supposed to go, where it's supposed to be. And you look at the electrical and it's a bunch of squiggly lines to me. And somebody can somehow look at that information and tell me that, like, hey, this means you need 20 conduits going from here to here. And it's like, how the heck did you figure that out?
You don't read one line diagrams?
Yeah. It's amazing with that. So I'd say as far as the content of the model, like, we probably don't pay too much attention and it probably doesn't bog it down. But you start getting an architect's model, and then you get the mechanical design, and then you get the electrical design, and then you start getting other contractors putting stuff there. And all of a sudden, the links take up a pretty hefty amount of
especially if you get somebody else's model that's referencing somebody else's model that you already have in your model.
Right. Yeah. You start getting all those circular references and stuff like that. But you know, if they start attaching rather than overlaying links in their model for sure. You know, but that's where we try to lend our expertise and tell those people, like, hey, you probably don't want to do this kind of deal. But just pure information and parts, like, our models just get bloated as is.
Yeah.
Worrying about any of the fabrication stuff, just because they are those extensive of families that are in there.
Well, you guys typically work on very large projects too, which is awesome. You guys are very fortunate. I love the projects you guys work on. Promote the hell out of them. They're cool projects. I don't know what you guys can say because NDAs and stuff.
Yeah, I don't think I'll dip my toe in that water.
You guys are like the projects that, you know, I'm just, man, you guys are on some damn cool projects. I think about, you know, not knocking Pittsburgh, right? You know, I don't see a lot of BIMs here. Like,
yeah, I don't think Pittsburgh understands what BIM even is. Realistically, and it's,
well, that's,
it's
insane, because, you know what, isn't it Pitt? Is it the University of Pittsburgh or Penn State?
Penn State.
Penn State writes all the BIM standards.
Don't get me started on that. I met the GC that helped write that stuff, and they don't do a bit of BIM.
Yeah, and if you want to consider them to be
advanced, take a drink.
Technically Penn State's not Pittsburgh. Yeah. But like this area is always a
That's true. You're right.
You know, as much as I don't like to admit it, they got Philadelphia mixed in there a little bit too, so it's an even mix. But you know, this area in Western Pennsylvania is always a bit of a lag. So right when we were figuring out, you know, what is this BIM thing, California was already master of the thing.
Yeah.
And like, we hadn't even heard of what it was, kind of deal. And we're trying to figure it out, I think, still to this day. But I mean, even a lot of our work, we definitely have work in Pittsburgh, but we've expanded far beyond the extents of Allegheny County here for a lot of our work.
When I was in Portland, and this goes back 10 plus years, I mean, probably even dating back 20 years, but like, if you could spell BIM, you would easily make $100,000 a year. I don't care if you had no experience, if you graduated college and you knew how to spell BIM, we're just going to throw at least $100,000 at you. And, you'll figure it out on a project. And you move out here and, you know, I run into people that are freaking amazing at what they do. They do aspects of BIM, but their company doesn't really do BIM. And, you know, they're making half that. And I'm like, you guys, come on, man. There's an industry here. Like, let's grow it. Let's do some stuff. You know, there's some companies here that are really doing stuff, but they're more focused on a national approach. And, you know, we got Walsh Construction, you know, has a big campus here, Walsh Group, whatever, has a big campus here. I met one of the founders who's retired. And they're, you know, they're pushing, you know, 3D, 4D, BIM, SIM, you know, workflows. And then we've got, you have Lighthouses and Larsons and a bunch of other companies that are of the BIM mind. It's just that usually when I see BIM on a project, it's a half-assed coordination, plan grid, and or, you know, a Procore, some kind of project management thing, and that can look at models and they think that they're doing BIM. It's like, no, just because somebody gave you a 3D model, that's not
now,
BIM.
No, it's not. But, you know, let's take a second to talk about, you know, BIM, and I kind of want to swing back to,
you know, kind of talking about Adam's point about models that can get, you know, bloated and they can get, you know, oversized. And obviously, managing your own content is going to come with an additional benefit in terms of, you know, the data, the eye in BIM, right, guys? We talk about the all-encompassing eye for BIM. In terms of like garbage in, garbage out, the more data that you can put in. But obviously, as Adam says there, we have to find a balance with the amount of data that you're putting in that model, right? But I think another piece of the coin, and I want to tie this back to, obviously, I want to get the conversation over into some fabrication and kind of an analysis on that side in terms of like job tracking, progress tracking, things of that nature. But one big thing that's on my mind right now is with the level of information that you can put or standardize inside of your families and start placing in your models, that gives you the capability to start like standardizing the data analysis, right? We were talking about that kind of before the call too. In terms of data analysis is a very important piece of your model, much further than just getting a count of something. Yeah, you can totally just label a box as an outlet and it's a cube that you place around and you can get the count for that item. But to take it a little bit further than that is to get the voltage or the wires that pass through it, you know, to know and understand what's happening with that object, how many objects that you have, how many similar references, how many, you know, different objects that you have. That's really the benefit of BIM. And as we start to tie that to, you know, like I was saying there, your prefabrication into your fabrication and installation workflows, I think there's a huge piece for progress tracking that, I mean, I haven't really been able to get into yet, but I'm curious if you guys have seen any benefits there.
Yeah, we're getting into progress tracking right now. So we're on a couple of projects we have assembled. And mm-hmm. we're using that for field tracking. So we're basically able to set certain statuses of things up to a certain point. But it's always where it seemed like a great concept that you're going to be able to status this whole thing along. And then all of a sudden, you're going to be able to publish your model in ACC and see all the colors. And by the colors, you're going to know what the status is. But what always happened was it hit the field and it just died. Or it would hit your fab shop and it would die. At a certain point, once it leaves basically the quote unquote office, like, you know, it was always a crapshoot at what point the whole thing would just, you know, fall apart. And so we're leveraging Assemble now by exporting out some of the views for things. Basically, you can see the model that's there. So it's almost like a quote unquote model viewer, mm-hmm. but it's allowing the field to go in and set status as a part of the model. And then we can re-ingest that stuff into Revit to be able to see that stuff if we want to see views of what basically what the status is. It's worth its weight in gold whenever you can take a view on an iPad like that. And someone says, we're going to make a change over here. And you just say, all the stuff that's colored this, like it's already built. It's sitting on the floor. It's at fab. It's going on the truck. It's coming out next week.
To know when it gets on site, when it gets plugged in, pressure tested, everything. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, bud.
Oh, no, you're good. I was just saying, like, it's awesome to be able to see, to track that as it, you know, as it, like you were saying, as it's delivered on site, as it's installed, it's pressure tested or performance function tested, right? To be able to connect all of those different dots with that piece of equipment or that item that you're tracking. Dude, one piece, I mean, I'm geeking out a little bit, Joe, and I apologize for interrupting you here, dude. I'm a little
first new buzzword, one. Dave's geeking out.
I am, right? I mean, so one big thing, dude, I want to see in the future, I see the dots, but they haven't aligned. The stars have not aligned for us yet. But speaking of, you know, the field workflow, I think the assemble piece is huge. It kind of produces a piece of what we used to have with like glue, right? But in my mind, updating statuses and things of that nature, that's awesome. But the real value is actually, I mean, well, there's another real value would be being able to actually input data into the model, into, you know, parameters essentially for the Revit elements, being able to actually track that. And I mean, I know that we have some capabilities with, let's say, assets or, you know, different things of that nature. But in my mind, dude, it would be so awesome to give the field personnel the capability to see that, you know, AHU, the RT, whatever it is, that piece of equipment, that those items that they're installing, and actually status it right there and be able to plug in the information if they change a circuit for where this switch went to, and like, oh, you know what, actually I put this to this circuit. They can just quickly put that data and change that in and update that model, right? I'm excited. I mean, obviously I see, you know, the parameter capability, like the management capability, but I have not seen, you know, the functionality yet to be able to input that data into the model.
Yeah, and all of that stuff is really important to us too. So all of that, I certainly hope people don't go and start switching circuits. That'd probably end up pretty horrible.
Right.
But all of that information, you know, I was kind of alluding to the one position that we have. They're union electricians, and they're laying all this stuff out for VDC to be able to input 3D content into a model. They're figuring all that stuff out of what wires are there, what circuits are there, all of that stuff. And all of that is all pushed into parameters within the model. So as these things move along, you can either A, while doing coordination, B, while it hits fabrication, or C, when it hits the field, that information is tied to those conduits the whole way through, so even the guy in the field can see, oh, I know exactly what's going to be inside of this conduit. I know what I'm in for later on whenever I have to go pull wire for any of this stuff.
We used to do that workflow kind of with glue, but we would have to do all the color coding in Revit,
mm-hmm.
and then re-update. That's kind of a pain, and then it always had to go back to somebody that knew Revit. But if you're doing this in Assemble, I mean, that's a pretty cool workflow to push that. Because then it doesn't have to be somebody that knows Revit per se.
Yeah, well, I mean, it pushes all of, like, the statuses is basically the updating of what's happening in Assemble. And I'm not personally working in Assemble, so a lot of what I'm saying is sort of secondhand kind of thing. But that's the part that's really getting the tie. And it's always the, we talked about getting red lines from a field. And, you know, I've had plenty of times while working for on the mechanical side of things where you'd get beat up for 2 years along the project about how terrible your drawings were, nothing fits, and it's all a big problem. When it comes time to get the red lines from the field, it's, no, I put it in just like you drew it, man, like, good work. And it's like, you've been kicking my butt for 2 years on how bad these drawings are, and it turned out that you put it in, quote unquote, just like we drew it. And, you know, so it's one of those things to finally get the field to buy in on something and you finally get that input back. It's really exciting to be able to do that. And it's like, okay, we got our foot in the door. Like what can we do now? And really trying to think of, like, you know, where does it really go from here?
If we can automate the verification process and then the re-as-built, like
that. Yeah,
the
dude.
Scan workflow might be too over the top, but what I'm saying is, like, something like that, that is monitoring the job site that tells you, okay, this has been installed per the model. If it hasn't, here's the deviation. Like, we use a software called Verity for verification that'll tell you this is out of tolerance with their model is, and it recognizes each individual element and object sort of thing. But that way you at least can bring it back over your model, tells you this is out of tolerance, and you can just move your model to align with that and say, all right, here's our as built.
Right.
But again, that's like a more in-depth scan workflow, and that might be on the GC side, not necessarily the subcontractor side, or even
I mean, we're getting into reality capture, so we're doing reality capture on a couple of jobs, but it's the same thing as all of those companies are trying to get into the, we can tell you if you installed your content, but it really works well for, like, ductwork and 12-inch pipe and stuff like that. And when we're saying, hey, can you tell me if my 3/4-inch conduit's installed? They're like, maybe not.
Yeah, it's a little small.
Yeah, it's like, but they're saying that they're working on all these things, and I'm sure that they are. But, I mean, it's not close to being rolled out and ready to go and very reliable or whatever. But hopefully I'm wrong and this thing's ready, like, next month or whatever. But it's like, the quality of captures is not what I'd like it to be currently, and I really highly doubt that based on the quality of the captures of what's coming out that they can somehow tell me that things are installed.
Yeah. So quality of captures being the scans that your people are taking, or quality of captures being the limitations of the software?
I think it's actually a limitation of the hardware and the software combined. So the stuff that we're talking about isn't necessarily like a LiDAR or anything like that.
It's a handheld.
It's a 360 camera that you're walking around with, and it's using time lapse.
Gotcha.
So those pictures, you know, unless you're perfectly still and no one's doing anything and there's no vibration anywhere, like, they might come out great, but, like, they're telling you to slap it on a hard hat and walk around for a while kind of thing. And it's grainy. There's low light conditions on jobs. I mean, there's a million reasons why. But if you use one of those 360 cameras and you take a video, it looks great.
Yeah.
But the time lapse, there's some quality issues. And I don't necessarily think it's a software problem on that end. I think it's more they're using that part of the technology within the camera because it's the least size of anything. If they were to use the video and try to do that, the processing power steps up significantly on there for them to be able to do that and pull captures out of the thing when the time lapse is theoretically already doing what they're attempting to capture out of the whole thing.
Yeah. Man. Technology has come a long way. 360 cameras, I remember like when they were first starting to pop up on job sites. Now it seems like everybody's got them. They're pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. I got a whole bunch just sitting at my desk.
Really?
I want to see some Tesla cameras, but strap them inside like the 360 cameras on the job site and be able to actually, but they got to fine tune it, obviously create walls, create things as they go up and actually save it to a database. I think in all reality, that's got to be the next step. I mean, somebody still has to take a scanner out there and actually stand and do the scan. And then they have to have a good plan on the data that they're wanting to collect.
Spot robot and all the things
I figured you wouldn't start pitching Spot the robot dog running around at midnight.
I'm not a fan of any automation running around the job site. There's so many like nuances for an unmanned thing on the job site. Stairs and
slap a camera up there, dude. Slap a camera up there that monitors all and slap several cameras up all over that job site, man.
You can't monitor all the every day. Like you can't model every obstacle that's on that job site for that thing to.
We don't need to model it and monitor it. It does. Like so, that's where we got to figure out like how to tie this together, man. Because there are
Roomba out there. Let it figure it out, man.
Hey, man, not even the Roomba, bro. I don't even want the Roomba. I just want a camera you slap up on a wall. We're talking some Batman type of stuff, like slap up on a pipe or a wall, it's sticky or something, and it just records everything. And
24/7, just always recording.
Recording. And
at least on the security side, I'm sure you guys see them on
They have that, but they don't translate that. You know, that's stored as video, or you know, some things will come up. Like they've started to introduce AI for safety measures and things like that.
If we can convert drone video into aerial
exactly
photogrammetry, we should be with this.
Exactly, dude. And I'm saying there's a lot of data there. It watches the time lapse. You can actually have it build out. There shouldn't be a reason why we can't have it build out an actual time lapse model of how things progressed or where they are currently, and give us the different walls, the pipes, the handrails, the scaffolding, whatever is in that project. Even if it's, obviously I would love for it to be Nat's Nuts accurate, but at first I don't expect that much. But if we can get a translation there, dude, in my mind, that would be the best, because then you can have an up-to-date, like it's constantly updating. It's a flow of data. Even if we can tap into that database and just start analyzing it in a way to figure out what our progress is looking like.
I know you went on a Hyperloop project and you were talking to them about deformation monitoring, but imagine like, mm-hmm. Something like deformation monitoring that's always looking at the same exact spots and looking at the changes in that spot as against the its time lapse, right, against the previous part, but it's always looking at the same spots. And maybe you have one camera for a room or something like that, but you're training it to look at you're just starting out, right? You're just training it to look at one wall. And we're teaching it to look at that wall to figure out what's changing with that wall, and then recognizing the parts and pieces that are in the wall until we're at the finished drywall phase. And then from there, we can kind of, back engineer it for a whole entire room.
Yeah.
I think the walls in that instance are probably your biggest enemy, because, if you've ever seen one of those cameras that they set up on a building across the street and you can start watching the building goes up, once they get the outside skin on, it's a pretty boring video.
Yeah.
That's true.
But that's the same concept with inside the building is like, it's wide open and you can do what Dave's talking about. And you can start monitoring roughing going on. But as soon as they top out walls or put walls up, like your video is garbage.
Well, you're done, right? Like, you're done with interior wall for the most part.
For the walls,
Then it's just about,
depends what you care about, though. If you care about walls, Yeah. Sure, okay, that sounds great. Yeah, the wall
you're going to have to move them. Yeah. You're right. Or you're going to have to put them where they can see walls and they can see pipe, as long as you don't have ceilings in yet. As soon as you put in ceilings, at that point, you got to go get
them. I want to know about the pipe in the wall or in the ceiling. Ceiling's probably a better example, right? Because that's where we're hiding everything. But, like, trying to look at one element of it to recognize all the different elements and then use that to apply to all of it. And I'm sure we could probably get there. We could probably make tweaks to that verification software. And
you could even train it to start scheduling for you and everything based on the progress of the overall job as things go in and it tracks. I mean, eventually, if you introduce intelligence into that, you probably could have it schedule in terms of, we know we're going to lay down, you know, this much lineal feet of wall. We're going to lay down this much pipe, this much duct. It could probably start scheduling everything out for you at that point.
But in the early days of BIM 360 Field and Glue, there was a company that was around. I don't know if they're still around or if they've been acquired. They kind of fell off my radar, but it was smartvid.io. They looked at your video and photos, and they analyzed them, and they were looking for
safety issues.
Yeah, they were looking for safety violations, right? That was their biggest thing. But they were detecting a seatbelt. They were detecting, like, they were trying to look at, oh, he's walking around, he didn't have PPE on. Like, they looked at all of this stuff, photos and imagery or video and stuff. Now, like, and they were analyzing it and reporting metrics. So, like, essentially the algorithms and the tools are there. We could just figure out a way to train them to look at the project and then compare that against the schedule. Maybe it's using Assemble and pulling from P6 and then updating. Anyways, man, we're going down a rabbit hole here.
We're solving technology. Yes, we are.
Somebody's going to take this idea and run with it. Alan Technology, man. Renee, he's over there typing this out.
Right. No, but, you know, with ChatGPT now opening up enterprise.
Oh my God, I knew you were
gonna say AI. Hey, man, come on. I can't even help it, bro. We start talking about AI. I got to, you know, everybody can now create their own GPT, their own AI. So, I mean, at this point, I think it's really we're kind of ripe for it. Like, people can and will create their own GPT environments for AI where we can start to feed this information to. Whereas you think a few years ago when something like that came out, I mean, it was unheard of to even have AI analyze your pictures and videos. Like, that was some CIA level type of stuff. I thought, I was like, man, this got some, you know, some born stuff in it. And I'm like, wow, some born identity kind of stuff going on over here. You know, but at the same time, we're ripe for this shift, man. I mean, the level of data that we track in typical projects, it's to the point now where people are on their cell phones, and if they have wireless on the job site, you can track their exact location on that job site and as they move around, kind of what they're doing. I mean,
we're tracking machinery on job sites now.
Exactly.
We're analyzing its stop and start point for to reverse schedule, to progress track, to do all kinds of crazy stuff. Like, it's coming. That said, man, I've said this a million times. I'm going to say it one more time, just today at least. The next 5 years is going to be fraught with AI use cases and case studies. We're going to be in the VR, AR phase.
Oh, we're going to be inundated with it, yeah.
We're going to be inundated 100%. With use cases that don't necessarily make sense, that are marketing gimmicks because somebody's got an investment. There are cool things. I was on a call, got an AI for BIM demo recently, and there's really cool use cases on rendering and you know, that sort of stuff for the AI piece. And there's coming stuff for the scan to, this is something I talked about you later, on the scan to BIM for AI stuff. But I still think we're 5 years away for any real meaningful, at least 5 years away, meaningful adoption outside of content creation for AI and construction. That's just my gut based off of the slow to adopt, because construction gets a bad rap, you know, and I said this earlier about Pittsburgh adopting BIM, but construction gets a bad rap for adopting technology. But if you think about it, all they do is adopt technology.
Yep.
All they do is, like, very rarely do you run into a construction firm that all they do is swing hammers or dig ditches with shovels. No, they've got expensive equipment and machinery and you know, they're constantly making innovations because they're the ones that are facing labor shortages more than anybody. They're the ones that are, you know, facing scheduling and estimating. Like, they adopt technology at unprecedented levels that kind of go unrecognized because, you know, one, nobody's capitalizing on that spend because it's a historical cost. You know, and they're just called laggards. But they're not, so, man. They adopt a lot of technology. That said, the AI piece, right. hold on, let me finish my thought,
okay.
Dave.
You're good.
That said, the AI piece, I think, is going to get adopted. You know, the large GCs of the world, the large subcontractors, are going to find out ways to make it meaningful, right? It analyzes data. The natural language learning module is cool. Content creation, as I said, that's more on the architectural and design side. There's going to be cool use cases. We're all going to use aspects of it, but for it to really take hold and actually make meaningful change or make meaningful impact in the industry, 5 years, dude. I'm telling you. Sorry, go ahead.
No. That's I'm glad that you wrapped up with that because I want to say I'm willing to bet that we cut that number in half. I mean, just with your points there, you're completely right. I mean, the construction industry is innovative, and we're at a point right now where we are adopting technology like nobody's business. I mean, were we having an integration and automation conversation even just, let's say, 3 years ago? No, not so much, right? I mean, we might have had some talk about some APIs, but really it wasn't a big conversation as it is today.
It's all about ERP integration, right? How do we tie this back to our – now it's, you know, more broader.
It's, you've got exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, and I mean, it goes back to like what we were talking about earlier. I mean – essentially, when you have the drive, right, when you want it, like Andrew has, like you figure out the integration pieces as you need to make these other pieces talk, you figure them out. And I think that's why I want to say we're going to cut this in half, because in all honesty, if you look around, dude, our industry has been ripe for change, and there are so many people adopting technology. Now, I do want to say, to your point, I do not think there will be mainstream use cases, mainstream like products, like Autodesk releases something or a big company releases a mainstream useful product. I could agree with you in 5 years. However, I think there are going to be firms like Lighthouse. There are going to be firms out there that will find the benefit in sooner than 5 years, because they're already on that path right now. Now, maybe, you know, we're not going to say it's full automation, but they can introduce intelligence into different pieces of their workflows because the capability is there. And now that is there, and we have the integration capability, OpenAI is fully open. Like, there's so many APIs you can connect with and send data back and forth. I mean, honestly, dude, I see it in, like I said, 2.5 years. What are your thoughts, Andrew? What do you think?
Adam. Why do you keep calling
Adam? I don't know. I'm looking at an Andrew right now. I don't know. I'm so sorry, dude. I'm looking at, yeah, right? Probably too much.
I'm looking at it. 3 years or so.
I'm looking at an Andrew right now on Teams. I got it up in front of me. I don't know why. Oh, it's Andrew Campbell. That's why. Sorry, guys.
All right, no worries. to jump up on your point real quick, Dave, I kind of agree with Dave's point. I think one thing we tend to overlook is that AI is not just a software. I mean, it's literally a tool. So I think as these different softwares come out with AI plugged into them, I think it's going to become much more widely adapted. I think what we're waiting for and what the five-year mark is really going to hold is the actual use cases that benefit different organizations. There's a lot of different ways right now to apply AI. And when we're talking about automating data, you know, going through the process of rendering different things, utilizing, you know, language-based models to run all the way through. AI as a whole is just like the word BIM or just like the word digital twin. Like, these are just macro, tools that are being used within the industry. There's a lot of different applications they apply to. And I do think, even starting now, we're seeing companies try to adopt different tools and resources that use AI at its base or at its core, you know, whether lightweight or extremely industrious and extremely innovative. But I do think it's going to take a lot less time than 5 years to start seeing these pop up in the industry. I think it's just going to be that 5-year mark where they become, you know, something standardized. A software that uses AI is standardized. And I think that's where we'll see it in the industry.
Analytics and automation are not AI, by the way. I just want to preface this. That is not AI. It is a benefit of AI. And I think we'll see those before we see AI take meaningful. Adam. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, dude. We're ranting and rambling because I'm the devil's advocate here. Let me hear some of your thoughts on the AI component, because we got to touch on it, right? Every episode now.
Yeah. I think everybody's right. I think you're going to get those, we'll say sooner, quote unquote, you know, 2-3 year, where some people are going to figure out how to leverage it to be successful and do the things that they want to do. I also think in that time frame, you're going to get someone to develop the AI version of Spot the Robot Dog that is going to be a cool gimmick, but it's not actually going to be useful when it's going to, for lack of a better term, set the timeline back. And then you're going to start to see in 5 years that the nostalgia will wear off on those things. And then you're going to start to see useful things come out of it. So I think everybody is correct in some way to say that the timeline is correct, but I think what comes in those timelines is vastly different, where you're going to get stuff where, in the shorter time frame, people who they're going to build something useful for them, but they're not going to necessarily build it for market.
Yeah, it's not for the mass.
Where that's you're going true. To get something that's the Revit that everyone's going to use in 5 years.
I think I'm living in the multiverse with these different timelines here. But, I think that what it's going to boil down to is there are going to be those that are probably more secretive, that are doing bigger things with it, that have built their modules and they're advancing it and all that sort of stuff. But I also think it's like, it's different than software and hardware technology, where that it's going to be changing so fast that what they're doing today, what they're building right now, is almost going to be outdated in 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
And in 2 years, that's when we're going to really start to see the development start to happen. And that iteration is where people are, because it's going to go leaps and bounds. We don't have quantum computing yet. That's coming. You know, we don't have real business adoption like Copilot and all those gimmicky things that were just released. They can do some cool things for automation, but they're not really in the business case use case yet. AWS, Azure, they're the more prevalent business tools that are starting to push the AI components. Google, you know, they say they're leaps and bounds ahead of everybody, but I ask Gemini questions and it's dumber than, you know, ChatGPT 3.5. ChatGPT is, to me, the iPhone, like what the iPhone was for scanning in our industry, right? It was a good catalyst to get people talking about it, but we still don't have mass scan adoption. We have, you know, buzzwords thrown around like digital twin and stuff like that. Everybody take a shot. We talk about, you know, what it can do for the industry and people are more accepting of it, but it still doesn't have the same level of adoption and mass adoption. And I feel like ChatGPT is doing that for us right now, where it's giving us broad appeal on a consumer level, but at the business use case, people are, you know, their gears are turning and they're trying to, you know, the Adam Wingard songs of the world are like, how can we use this? How can we figure this out and make a cool use case? But I don't know. I don't know. I'm playing both sides here. I don't think they're going
to
be there.
But I think I have to.
You have something to say, man.
I mean, you're mentioning the huge conglomerates and everything like that. And even if they build some crappy version of AI, quote unquote, they have to build some crappy version of AI to just keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
If Google decided we're not going to get into that until, you know, it's right, they're going to get left behind.
Yeah.
Because everyone is on a level playing field at this point, where you're saying like they're all doing AI, but like what does that even mean?
Yeah. Well, in AI 2 years from now, Gemini could surpass all of them. Google has the largest content library out of all of them to search through. AWS has the business applications. They're looking at, I mean, I don't know if they're allowed to, but they're, you know, they have all the platforms that they can look at and scour all the data they want from a business level application. Google has consumer level application and Microsoft has the actual applications that people have. So the race to figure out where people are, where they're going to be in 5 years, I mean, that's anybody's game.
But right now, they just got to say they're in the race.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't matter how they're performing in the race. They just got to say, I registered. Yeah. I'm in.
Now, I think
signing up for a half marathon doesn't mean you're going to do any good at it.
That's true.
I didn't drink, guys, but I'm here. Pay the registration fee. Give me my T-shirt.
No, I think obviously listening to you guys, you're completely right. When you look at the definition of artificial intelligence, it's got to be, you know, a level of generalized intelligence. It has to be all knowing, but it has to be able to keep up with the human's train of thought to be able to change topics or to be able to learn new things as quickly as a human does. But in my estimate of 2.5 years, I'm thinking that we will have focused AI kind of tools that we're seeing in the industry.
For our industry, yes, but not for maybe a few specific niches, but yeah.
Well, what I mean is construction is so broad, right? It is so broad in how it's done, whether it's MEP, it's structural, it's your. I mean,
MEP is all that matters, guys.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, but in general, like, let's say it's MEP, right? If you're doing a lot of mechanical, your AI might be focused towards, you know, mechanical, and it might not help your electrical. If you're doing all three, awesome. But even
it's going to be like Rabbit. It's meant for everybody. It works.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you think about the companies that are going to train these models, like Adam said. I mean, it's. They're going to train it to what they do, right? And that doesn't mean that that model is going to be beneficial towards someone else. I mean, it could if they do a lot of the same work, they still have to might tweak it to what they do. But at the same time,
I think what we're seeing though is a race for the money grab right now. I think what we're seeing is the let's develop this for the masses and it's going to work because we're developing it. For them in mind, but
yeah,
and it's going to do all things for all people, but really it does 1% of things really well, and everything else is like, yeah, they could use it or they could live without it like everybody else has done prior to this. Anyways, I think that's what we're seeing. It's going to get there eventually. I'm with you. I'm not anti-AI in most instances, but I just think the timeline might be askew. That said, what it does have going for it, it does have mass adoption right out the gate. It had the record level of adoption, you know, more so than any social media platform. People, you know, it's got a little wow buzz to it because everybody's like, you know, what is this going to do? How can I use this? How's it going to be beneficial? But it also is going to promote a lot of, unfortunately, you know, fluff marketing cases that get promoted that we just start seeing because everybody's saying they do AI. To Adam's point, they bought the jersey, they paid the registration fee for the marathon, and now they're doing AI, so to speak. But anyways, man, we're about an hour in. I think now's the perfect time to do a little shift here. We've talked about AI. We've talked about legacy construction technology, your background a little bit. I'm always curious to figure out what your current pain points are in the industry, and then where you kind of see the future of the industry going as a hope, or and just in general, as we're talking about AI, you know, where you want it to go and actually where you think it is going to go.
Yeah, I mean, even the AI aspect, I certainly hope Dave's right and I'm going to get into it tomorrow or whatever. But I think I'm especially with a lot of the applications that I develop with Dynamo and stuff, I really want and appreciate the human aspect to be in there. I can hard code anything and make it do the thing, but at a certain point, I don't want to build any kind of coding intelligence into that thing. I'd rather use the human who already has the intelligence to, you know, fill in the blanks for some of that stuff. So like the whole AI thing, I'm kind of in a wait and see kind of thing to see where it starts developing and start heading in that direction. Cause I think, like, you know, to your point, everyone's doing something and everyone's just throwing stuff around and no one's really, you know,
see what sticks.
Going in a particular direction right now. But, you know, to circle back on some of the other things for, you know, softwares and stuff, I think one of the biggest issues with that I found with softwares, and this is me just making a wild ass guess on a lot of this, is that the softwares that are being touted for people to do quote unquote BIM are being built by non-construction people. And where you get somebody who was involved in construction and they're the face of the company, you sit in a demo, oh, I did construction for 20 years or whatever. But everybody that's working for them and coding stuff is not a construction person, where I think a lot of our applications actually excel a bit because we are construction people that are coding things, not people that are coding things for construction people. You know, we're really focusing on making it work for the industry. And that's why a lot of the things that I'm doing is that even though it may be more clicks, it's going to end up being less clicks in the long run and more intelligent and more accurate, because you still have to have the human aspect to those things.
Well, too often we get thrown the wrench of, yeah, here's our tool for construction, and it gets you, you know, part of the way there, or it's not completely baked out in any meaningful way, but we want to work with you on it and figure it out. But you know, but really what they don't understand is that in construction, it has to work. It has to work. Like, I don't have time to devote to a project that, you know, is halfway there, because otherwise we're just spinning our wheels. My project has a timeline. I'm billable so many hours. I have another project I had to get to. Like, let's get this thing going and give me a solution that works today. What you're doing, what you're talking about, means that you're vetting it through the whole entire process. You're not building some, you know, nice UI, but with clunky workflows that may or may not fit a solution. You're actually like, no. It does this, it does this, it does this, and it's going to save you all this because you did these 10 steps now.
It's like the discussion on BIM. When BIM came around, we'll say 15, 20 years ago in this area, it was, okay, I want BIM. And someone said, well, here's the price tag on the front end to do BIM. And it said, oh my God, I can't
afford this. Yeah.
And it's one of those things that, like, yeah, the tools that I'm developing, technically, quote unquote, in the initial button click, they may be slightly slower, but they save you that time on the back end because you don't have to do the things you're talking about by going and validating stuff that's in there. You can be comfortable in knowing that these things are just done correctly the first time. It's, if you do it once and it's correct, you know, you don't end up doing it twice and spending twice as much money on the whole thing.
Yeah. So back in the day when I was doing the Autodesk BIM 360 early days, Field and Glue kind of pushing that talk track, there was this metric that was always thrown around. It was like 25% of a project's cost or its rework or something, like something insane. It's like, oh yeah, imagine we could mitigate the amount of rework or duplication of effort if we just did it all early on, did the coordination correctly, did the all the button clicks and front loaded the data so that by the time we actually got to construction or through the handover process, there's less of that rework, less of that duplication of data. And so there's always some, right? But the more we can reduce, the better and cheaper it could all. It could be overall. Maybe it's more expensive on the front, but that overall project cost is actually a lot less. And maybe that leads to us as an MEP firm selling services, you know, the mechanical piping side, selling services to the building after the fact, because we have that data. We went through the efforts of setting it up this way. The project was done correctly. The owner's happy. And now we've set ourselves up for success with the service contract because we, you know the warranties and serviceability of the project.
Yeah, especially even on the mechanical end of things, they had a pretty extensive service department there, and they would make it a standard, like, okay, as we put equipment in there, we have standard tagging and things that go with that. We have the information for all of that. So after the fact, it's like, hey, we're turning this building over, but like, guess who knows the most about the project? Like, it's me, and I put all the tags on here. Like, I can sell you a service contract. So it's, you know, where can you be opportunistic for that? But you know, what you were talking about sort of made me think of the one picture that I've seen before, where a guy has this little tiny boat that says original bid that's being towed by the yacht that says change order. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of one of those things. It's like, you know, where do we get it? So it's like there's just one boat there that's the whole thing, and not like, you know, how can I make money after the fact by, like, you know, lowballing to
yeah.
start on the whole thing.
Yeah, we underbid on purpose because we know we're making money later on.
Right.
I think those days are starting to phase out. Now we're starting to see, yeah, there's going to be the you know, the large tech companies that will foot the bill for the change orders because they wanted something different. But
sure.
You know, those projects, you know, those are good. They do happen. But now it's starting to be, you know, how accurate are you with that bid? Because you might not have that level of a change order. Dude, that slide was in like every Autodesk presentation for so many years. I remember like seeing, I went to one presentation with a civil guy who was getting in the construction side. And I left that presentation to go to a presentation that Lynn Allen was doing back when she was with Autodesk. And they have the same damn slides. Like, these aren't even the same talk tracks, but you got the same slides. It's great.
Right. Yeah, one of the things you were talking about, too, is just like, you know, you get into some projects with tech companies and they want, like, the newest thing on there, whether it's vetted or not. I mean, that's one thing that I always struggle with, and I try to, you know, I really have to try to weed through what's coming through. But somebody will go to a conference, see a whole bunch of flashy crap, and come back and be like, oh man, we need to do this thing, and you're like, that's, you know, I can already see where this is going with the whole thing. But it's just like, it's one of those things that if they get enough people excited, they can make money off of that stuff. It's like, it doesn't matter if it's useful to the industry, they just need to try to make a buck, and they made the cool sexy thing that everybody wants, that you know, you have this sort of look at and just say, it's like, yeah, that is pretty cool, but like, I don't see how that's useful to us.
Yeah, we've talked about the early days of VR and large tech companies saying, yeah, use this on my project and give me a case study for an Autodesk. No different. Yeah. I've worked on an Autodesk project and they mandated that you use the Autodesk construction, the predecessor of the Autodesk Construction Cloud, and ends up in a nice little case study somewhere. Look at the metrics and the time saved. And it's like, this was your project, Mr. You know, right. Microsoft or whoever, you know, VR company, AR company. You know, I love being on those projects too, because the marketing says subcontractor saved, you know, X amount of hours because they caught a coordination issue that by walking around the model and the headset that they didn't catch, and the automated clash detection tools that do it all for you, like. Don't give me that. Like, and then you talk to the POC there, and he's like, no, that's marketing, dude. Just don't listen to that.
Yeah, but even those companies are the ones that are always just like, hey, I'd like to do a pilot project with you, and then they do that stuff, and then they put that case study out after the fact. And, you know, of course, you pay all that money for a case study. I mean, you're not going to make it sound bad.
No.
Oh, yeah, you're going to make it look, you know, pretty rosy, and it's just like, oh, look at all the money that we saved by doing this.
So, like, years ago, there was, you know, the metric that construction was laggards behind agriculture as far as adopting technology. And that's true. And it's probably even still true today. And that's because agriculture is now large scale, multinational, global corporations that will send drones out. They'll tell you that, you know, they have sensors on the drones that tell you the crop. This needs pesticides. This needs water. This needs herbicides. This needs the nitrogen's low over here. Sends out a machine. It swivels the water around. Like, it does all this stuff for you. And that's automated. It's a very horizontal rollout of technology. Construction, there's vertical, and then there's interior to the vertical. It's just, it's crazy. So maybe we are laggards in the adoption of technology. That doesn't mean that we didn't adopt technology.
I think they're adopting technology, but you got to take it for what it is. It's not a one-to-one thing. So like a drone makes sense in certain instances, but I've had companies say, oh, you guys should get a drone. I'm like, okay, what for? They say, well, you can take a picture of all the lights on the outside of the building. I'm like, so what about the other 99.9% of the work we do? Like, can you fly in the building? They're like, well, no. And I'm like, that it doesn't work for us. Like, so drones are pretty cool. I'd love to have a drone and be able to fly it around, but like, is it useful? Like, no, not really.
You want me to fly a drone to count the 37 lights that are exterior?
Yeah, right.
But I've got 2,000 interior lights that I need to worry about.
Exactly.
Come on, man. Yeah. No, and drones do have their place. I'm with you. Technology does have their place. But what I was meaning to say was, we have adopted technology, but now people took that marching notice to say, or that as marching notice to say, oh, construction has adopted technology. Let's dump a bunch of money in construction and inundate it with every little app. They all do the same thing for the most part. And I'm not anti-technology. I'm one of the biggest technologists out there. I love technology. I love playing with it. Let's figure out how to make it useful. But I feel like we're at a stage now where it's like everybody's saying this is technology for the construction industry. One-tenth of it might be, and I think I'm being very conservative with those numbers.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, even what part of the construction industry? So there's a lot of different softwares and things that I've looked at that really gear towards general contractors because they're the ones with the most money.
Yeah.
They got the biggest contracts. They got the biggest stake in the game because people were working for them.
And yeah, they only make 2% margin, though.
But it's like, yeah, but at the same time, it's like, you know, they got the most, you know, to gain from anything. And then whenever we look at those processes and we say, okay, well, how does this piece of software work for us? And they're like, well, you can do this. And I'm like, well, we don't really do that. The general contractor does. Like, well, you can do this. I'm like, well, we don't really do that kind of thing. And it's, you know, it's very clear that they are not making a one size fits all. They are gearing it towards one specific group and then like trying to convince somebody like, yeah, you can probably wedge your processes into this thing and make it work.
Do you think that that's because those are the people that they went to first and said, hey, help me figure out how to make this useful? Because they had, like you said, they had the most money or maybe the most to gain from it, or maybe they were most willing to talk about technology at the time. And now they develop their round peg for that industry that takes the, or that segment that takes the round peg. And now they're just going out to the rest and saying, hey, this round peg works over here. It's going to work for you guys too. And your triangular or square or octagonal hole, mm-hmm. It's not exactly working.
Yeah. I mean, I see it a lot with the, you know, talking about a lot of the softwares for modeling stuff. It's like they all came out of either Dr. Pipe. Nobody, you know, for the most part, started with conduit. And it's like
the redheaded stepchild.
And it's one of those things. They're like, well, it does all this stuff with pipe. And it's like, well, does it work for conduit? They're like, not yet. But like you said, they're like, but if you partner with us, we can make it work for conduit. And I'm like, well, we're not really interested in that because we'll just build our own thing instead of, you know, working with you guys. But at the same point, it's if you dig into like Revit's API on how to make it do things, you can tell that the pipe and the conduit, they were written by two completely different people that never talked to each other in the history of the world. They aren't even close. So it's not even like you can say, hey, these workflows work for pipe, but I bet you they'll work for conduit. It's like, yeah, it ain't going to be close. Yeah. Not at all.
Just because it's a round pipe-ish object.
Right.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about point load calculations and looking at, there's a point load calculation software that works for water and pipe, because we can estimate that. But the parameters, as you were saying, the different types of wire, the, you know, what's in that conduit changes, and that mm-hmm. weight changes. So therefore the calculations change. What works for one isn't true across all.
Right.
All right. So knowing these pitfalls, knowing where we're at, knowing the shortcomings of technology, yes, we're being inundated and there's cool, awesome stuff. We want to play with it all and it's all great. And figure out how to make use cases. But there's also a lot of, oh, that's clearly a marketing gimmick. Knowing all this going on, what are you most excited for, though? Like, what's out there on the horizon? And it's close, but, you know, that you're very hopeful for.
I think it's something that we're really doing in-house. So I'll tell you, I love watching software demos, and I like to go and steal their ideas. I'm real big in doing Dynamo stuff and building scripts, making them work for our processes. We've switched our mentality a little bit to where we're basically mimicking a lot of the other softwares, where we have our content library and we're building these scripts that make the stuff do the things. But we're looking more towards the future of making that more widespread for others. So we're helping companies that we've joined ventured with in the past by kind of getting their whole BIM departments up and running and stuff. But really the thing that I'm probably the most excited about is that we're taking what we've built in Dynamo and we're just going to take it, pull it right out of Revit, and we're going to build our own ad and then inject it back in with, you know, buttons that are going to do, you know, we're going to build our own software essentially for the whole thing. But even if it were to fall flat on its face for, you know, marketing to other people, it's something that's going to work really well for our processes, for everything. But you know, I love seeing those software demos because I get ideas all the time. And I was just like, yeah, I don't want your software, but I'm going to steal half your ideas that you had on there. I'm going to take all the crappy ideas and I'm going to throw them away. And I'm going to take all the good ones and take them back and just build them myself or whatever. But, you know, another thing that I really love doing is that we have a piece of software already. And I'm like, yeah, I can replace that thing. And I've done it with a couple of softwares where I'm able to build something out and we just completely ditch the software altogether and server saves our, you know, however many couple thousand dollars a year per license on things. And it's like,
well, that adds up. That's a multiplier.
Well, it's one of those things. It's like, it's really cool to see with any of that. And, you know, I'll echo Dave's thing and start geeking out here a little bit. But I like to check out the analytics of stuff that we're doing and try to put like a cost to it and see, you know, what we're saving on these things.
Well, that's the way to sell the future of development to the internally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Look what we've saved so far. Here's the ROI.
Yep.
So what I'm hearing, though, and it sounds like Lighthouse is going to be creating a new tool and sponsoring Brewing with BIM with it so that we can get the message out there.
Yeah, that might be some time. It's one of those things though that we're definitely not going to do anything crazy with, you know. Essentially, the most important thing to me is that with any of this development stuff is that it benefits Lighthouse Electric.
Yeah.
If it's something where it could benefit others, I love helping people out. I mean, that's the thing that gets me going is, you know, we talked about like, you know, staying humble with anything or whatever. It's just like, if you looked at like my LinkedIn profile, you're not going to see a post from me hardly anywhere. I think I posted like two things ever kind of deal. It's something where helping people really gets me excited. And when people, show gratitude in person, it means a lot more than a like on a post or something. And being that, you know, just interacting with you, Joey, and you, Dave, on things, and you guys think it's really cool what's going on. Like you didn't see something from me out there. Like you either heard word of mouth or you saw the things that were going on. And you're like, wow, that's pretty cool. And like, that's something that means a lot to me is that, it's not like, you know, just, you know, some random profile somewhere, someone giving you a like, thumbs up or something like that to do it. Of course, there's got to be some kind of marketing gimmick that's in it eventually.
Yeah.
Well,
monetizing it when you get down that route.
Yeah, but you know, the most important thing is to, you know, it's the company first, and if it works for other people, awesome. But it you know, worst case scenario, it's going to be an excellent product for us to continue doing what we're doing, but take it a step farther. It's the same concept of getting involved with Dynamo and not knowing Python. And you can only do so much and your hands are tied to what other people will develop. But once you learn Python and you start investigating the API, you've unlocked another 90% of Dynamo stuff on there.
Yeah.
But now that you pull that stuff even out of Dynamo and take it the next step farther, you're going to be able to do so much more with those kind of things and build something that's useful for the industry rather than a money grabbing thing.
Those are my favorite ones, that company creates something and it spins out. I was telling you earlier about my buddy Britton Langdon, who went to created M Suite. It was a tool for the company he worked at. They, you know, kind of morphed and funded him, said, hey, go out and make this, go do something with it, and create his own company and kind of pushed it. I got a buddy, Eric Posey, who kind of worked for another company. They funded, you know, did the same thing. I don't know where that company went, but he's at another company that he started now. But it's always great to see people in industry that have solved their own problems. Other people have looked at it and be like, that's actually pretty cool. It actually works really well. And then you start to see their success and their transition and into actually serving the rest of the industry. And unlike the other subcontractors, not that, you know, mechanical and piping are, you know, too far off this, but I think the electrical contractors, being that they were the redheaded stepchild of BIM, really dove right into it. Like, you know, forming Electry, putting Josh Bone, who is the freaking BIM man, you know, like getting the evangelism out there about actually technology in this civic industry and then connecting everybody. You guys, we talked about peer groups. Like, there's a lot of peer groups on all sides of the fence and everybody's sharing it, but You know, Nika's actually developed their own essential peer group through Electri, you know, more or less, where they're kind of helping figure out what actually works, what doesn't work, and bouncing ideas off of them. And that Nika conference, man, it was as big as AU. It was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty. I'm excited to see it in San Diego later this year.
It sounds like you're just excited for San Diego. And
you know what? So AU's in San Diego this year, and I was thinking about it. I'm like, if I had to go, if I only went to one conference this year, I'd probably not go to AU and go to Nika. I had such a blast.
Yeah, I think I'm. I don't know. I think I got maybe the bad taste in my mouth. The only AU I've been to was the one in New Orleans.
It was not a good one, man.
And, you know, I heard a whole bunch of feedback on that. But at the same time, too, with any of that, I mean, the real reason that I wanted to attend was class content and networking. The networking was still there.
Yeah.
The class content was underwhelming.
Yeah.
But everybody was too concerned with, oh, the parties aren't as good. And I'm like, you know, and I'm a bit of an introvert. I don't even want to go to the party, to be honest with you. It's like, you know, I came here for a reason. I want to learn new things. And that was the part that was a bit underwhelming for me about the whole thing. So hopefully it's different.
Yeah.
As it goes on. But we'll see.
Yeah, I can't speak to the class content in Vegas, but the parties were definitely better. it had a great turnout. We had quite the event. I don't know. I thought it was good to be back in Vegas, where I think the event belongs of that size. You know, it's nice to bounce around, and so we'll see how it works in San Diego, but. Mm-hmm. The layout for Vegas or for New Orleans was just not conducive to it. You know, hey, but Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, come on, man, let's go. Let's bring it to PA, guys.
Some market drive. Yeah. That'd be handy. Yeah.
You know, the rumor was thrown out Nashville a few times, and then that didn't happen. I guess it got outvoted, but I'm down for Nashville, man.
Yeah, so it's good to see that they are venturing out. I thought they'd be a little hesitant and just lock into Vegas for forever just because of how New Orleans went.
Vegas was a scramble because they had to get out of that 3-year deal with New Orleans. And the rumor was that they're going to be in Vegas for a few more years. But I've heard that, you know, take this with a grain of salt. This is all rumors and hearsay. But I've heard that, you know, somebody at Autodesk doesn't like Vegas, so therefore they don't think it's an AU friendly town, and it's not reflective of AU's goals. So they're trying to move it around across the country, which is great too, because you're going to get a different crowd wherever you go and stuff. And
sure,
the more East Coast you go, look, nobody wants to jump on a plane and fly for 6 hours to go hang out in, you know, smoky casinos for 3 days. Vegas is cool, but I'm going there. I want to see something. You know, I want to be wild. It was just nice to have the networking aspect of it. That said, if it's going to be on the East Coast, you know, hey, you know, it's a shorter travel. You know, you might see people that normally wouldn't have gone because it's cross country and budgets. You know, companies, the travel costs are probably minimal. You know, compared to actually having somebody out of the office for 3 days, or a team of people out of the office for 3 days. You know, I know people that sent 20 people to AU, and they're not a reseller. So they're actually performing in industry. That cost has got to be monumental.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, hey, I think now is probably a good time to wrap it up, go get some food or something. But this was great, dude. I got to have you back on more, and we need to have you back on, especially when you guys are ready to release the tool that you were alluding to.
Appreciate you guys having me on.
Well, thank you all. Appreciate it. Thanks to all our listeners. As usual, you can find us at brewingwithbim.com or on any of the audio platforms.